Hello and welcome to episode number 34 of The Music Plays the Band on the Pantheon Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Koritz of the Dark Star Orchestra. I hope you all are safe and well. Well, I'm still coming to you from the homestead where it's allergy season, I might add. Our month off is just about to end, but it has been some great family time, and I am re-energized and I'm ready for spring tour. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the last episode with my guest Jackie Green. I've gotten some great feedback, and it is much appreciated. As you may remember, we dedicated that episode to Rick Turner, who passed away on April 17th, just days after I'd seen him at the Skull and Roses Festival out in Ventura, California. Rick was an iconic and groundbreaking luthier who was not only integral to the Grateful Dead, but helped to shape the sound of rock and roll in the 60s and 70s. His contributions to the world of electric guitars included starting Alembic in the 60s, the Modulus Guitar Company in the 70s, and designing and building guitars that were used by Jerry Garcia, Phil Lesh, Jack Cassidy, and Lindsey Buckingham, just to name a few. His vast knowledge of sound properties and equipment were at the forefront of the industry, and he was one of the creators of the Dead's famous Wall of Sound. I had the pleasure of meeting Rick last year and was able to document a conversation with him last June that I split over four episodes, starting with number 16. At the time, I cut out a lot of the super technical stuff, but today I'm bringing it to you largely unedited. Rick had had a resurgence in the public eye lately, with his famous Mission Control bass used by Phil, and Jerry's Peanut guitar back out there and being played by some of today's finest Grateful Dead musicians. When I saw him in Ventura just days before his passing, he was helping to curate a lending library of iconic instruments and was just so happy that the instruments were being played, rather than being behind glass in a museum case. While this is not a typical feature that I might bring you, I think it's important to honor a man who was a legend to many, but may have been more of a behind-the-scenes yet very important force in the world of the Grateful Dead and music in general. Even though many of you might not be well-versed in the technical side of the music industry, there's a lot here that's really, really interesting, and it's quite a history lesson as well. So before we get started, I humbly ask you to support the podcast any way you can. There's the monthly Patreon subscription with giving levels starting as low as $5 a month, which gives you exclusive bonus content, including outtakes, expanded interviews and segments, videos and stories from home and on the road, and much, much more. You can also make a one-time contribution through PayPal, and a portion of all proceeds goes to the Rex Foundation, the charity started by the Grateful Dead. You can find out about all of this and more at www.themusicplaystheband.net, and wherever you are listening, please take the time to rate, like, and review. So let's get started with my unedited conversation with the legendary Rick Turner. Okay, well, here I am today, and I have my friend Rick Turner with me. How are you, my friend?
I am great. I'm great, Rob.
Thank you so much for taking the time. You know, when we met a couple weeks ago in Santa Cruz, I was just like, we had some great stories. I was like, I got to get him on the podcast. There's so much to hear from him. So I appreciate you taking the time. So you are a master luthier. You've built guitars for some legendary players. You've co-founded Alembic Guitars. Some of your earliest guitars were built for members of the Dead. How did you get started in this business?
Well, I started off as a folkie back east. Going back into my high school years. So I did my first major restoration when I was about 15 years old, and it was on a Fairbanks and Cole 5-string banjo that I found in an antique store in my hometown of Marblehead, Massachusetts. And I'd gotten into the Kingston Trio at that point, and I was headed down that folky path. And when I went off to a boarding school for 3 years, I just got deeper and deeper and deeper into the folk scene. And I'd grown up in a town where people made stuff. They made boats. So working with your hands and making stuff was kind of normal to me. And, I'd had a boat when I was a kid. I did a lot of the maintenance on it myself. So the idea of working on the instrument was, it's just kind of a natural, you know? So I graduated from high school in 62, wound up at Boston University the fall of 62. And, I hated BU, but I loved the coffee house scene. So I majored in coffee house. and got to see amazing performers. This was a time when, you know, when you could see Bill Monroe in a coffee house, or Mississippi John Hurt, or Reverend Gary Davis. And it was an amazing scene. I started going to the Newport Folk Festivals, and I was playing guitar, and I got good enough at playing guitar to you know, be playing in some of the coffee houses with friends. But in, I guess it was 63, I found a guitar repair shop in Boston. I'd been making some woven leather guitar straps, and these guys really liked the straps and said, come work for us. And, you know, in about a week and a half, I made more guitar straps than they could sell in 6 months. And so there was a pile of Mexican, paracho made classical guitars that a local folky music store had bought, that imported them. I think they'd paid $8 a piece for these guitars or something like that. But 12 of them fell off of a rack onto the floor. And so there was everything wrong with them that you could imagine. And my bosses at the string instrument workshop said, well, Rick, why don't you start learning how to fix these things? And so bit by bit, I started picking up some luthery skills from these two guys that were, one guy was a great jazz guitar player, and the only problem with him in luthery was that he was paranoid as hell of hurting his hands. The other guy was a really good cabinet maker with no real guitar connection. But between the two of them, they were figuring it out. So come along to 1965, I'd gotten good enough banging out licks on my D28 to get a gig with the Canadian folk singers Ian and Sylvia. Fast forward to a Grateful Dead connection. Ian and Sylvia were on the Festival Express.
Right.
Yeah. And 5 years before that, I was their guitar player. And, you know, so it was about 9 months of 1965 playing venues like Boston Symphony Hall and Lincoln Center in New York, Hollywood Bowl.
Wow.
Just amazing venues, and a lot of coffee houses. And for the last 5 months of it, Ian and Sylvia hired a bass player, Felix Popolardi, who went on to become Mountain's, Cream's producer and the bass player and singer in Mountain. So, so I vaulted, you know, at age 22 into a pretty elite scene of the, you know, God, I mean, there were, how many people had a gig like mine in the United States? Maybe 6 or 7.
Right.
You know, and did a studio album with them. Subsequently, I'm on a Live at Newport Folk Festival album with them too. But I sort of maintained my interest in hands-on stuff. So moving on to 66, Sylvia was pregnant, didn't want to tour for a while. And I wound up moving from Cambridge to New York and joining a rock and roll band. And so suddenly I was, you know, no more D28. I'm dealing with electric guitars. And they felt alien to me at first. And then I got into it. And then in it must have been late 66 or early 67, a fan of our band was an apartment manager in New York. He managed some building on the Lower East Side or something like that. And a tenant had left and left behind this smashed Les Paul Custom. Neck was okay, which is really odd, because those necks break easier than anything. So I had a cabinet shop rough out a mahogany body to a shape that I designed, and that became the guitar ultimately known as Peanut. That when I moved out to the West Coast and essentially stopped playing electric guitar, I sold it to Jerry Garcia. And so that's the album that's on the Skullfuck album.
Right.
That's the guitar on the Skullfuck album, you know, or one of them. So anyway, so we, the band Auto Salvage, recorded for RCA. Our album went lead. We got great reviews in a couple of magazines, including Rolling Stone. But by the time the Rolling Stone article came out, the band was essentially defunct. Yeah. You know, it's the usual thing, you know. It was kind of like our Spinal Tap moment. You know, we get the great review when the band just split up, you know.
Right.
So, so my wife and I moved out to California. Our very good friends, who were the Youngbloods, had moved from, they got together in Massachusetts, kind of starting in Martha's Vineyard, then Cambridge, moved to New York, and then they moved to California, to Marin County, to West Marin. And, you know, they encouraged me to move out. I had hoped to bring the band with me, and we had some potential gigs lined up, but the band wouldn't move. I did. So I wound up in California in 68, a little house out in West Marin, and I was doing studio work, recording with a guy who had left the Youngbloods, Jerry Corbett. We did Don McLean's first album together. I played bass on that album. And there was a Jerry Corbett solo album that Charlie Daniels produced. And so from 68 into 1970, I was still being a pro musician but being a craftsman too. And I decided that I wanted, you know, I knew a couple of people that were one-man shop building acoustic guitars, and I decided I wanted to be the one-man shop, electric guitar person, right. Electric bass. Sure. And at that time, you know, we're looking at 1968-69, you couldn't buy pickups. I mean, Seymour Duncan wasn't around, and Larry DiMarzio wasn't around, and Gibson wasn't selling pickups, Fender wasn't selling pickups. But I'd known Dan Armstrong in New York and saw what he was up to, and I figured, well, you know, what's a pickup? It's a magnet structure and a coil of wire. So I went to Radio Shack and bought some magnets and bought some wire and started laboriously, literally hand winding pickups, one, two, right. Three, you know, and eventually, I'm tired of that actually pretty quickly and built up a little machine with a sewing machine motor and a speed control and a counter on it. And at that time, the Youngbloods were there. I also wound up doing some roadieing for them and mixing sound for them. Their office was in Point Reyes Station. The secretary was a woman named Florence Nathan, who went on to become known as Rosie McGee. You know, one of the, you know, right. You know, Rosie, you know, yeah. So she saw what I was up to. I'd built a bass. My first instrument was a bass for Jesse Colin Young. And she said, "Oh man, you ought to meet my boyfriend and meet the band." And that meant Phil Lesh and the Grateful Dead. And so she arranged for me to go out from Point Reyes to the Dead's Pink Warehouse in Novato, and where I met the band and met Owsley and Ron Wickersham, who was working on electronics for the band. And and I turned out to sort of be the missing link. I mean, Bear Owsley had this concept of a group of engineers and technicians and craftspeople, and he called it Alembic. And he'd brought in, and he had Bob Matthews and Betty Cantor Jackson, recording engineers and live sound mixers. Ron Wickersham, who was an electronics genius and had come from Ampex. And I showed up, and I became the sort of the designated luthier, but I also was quite familiar with how recording studios work from being a musician and in a recording musician. And also I'd been out on the road mixing the Youngbloods. So it was very convenient to have me as someone who could fill in here and fill in there. And, you know, so in spring of 1970, there was this idea of doing this cross-country caravan. This became the Great Medicine Ball Caravan. And the Dead were supposed to be on this tour. The idea was take a bunch of musicians and 100 other people and gear and do a bus tour from the West Coast to the East Coast and then to England and sort of reverse the cultural migration of East to West and go West to East with a bunch of hippies, you know. And so we, Alembic, signed on to do the PA and the live 16-track recording. And in order to be able to sign a contract with Warner Brothers, they insisted that we incorporate. So we did. And the three stockholders, three equal stockholders, were Bob Matthews, Ron Wickersham, and myself.
And this is the genesis of Alembic then, right there.
This is the official, this is Alembic becoming a real company. Yeah. So that would be June of 1970. And, you know, we somehow magically acquired a whole bunch of assets that included the PA system that Bear had paid for. He did not want to be an official part of the corporation. You know, he was always tried to be as underground as he could be while being in the middle of it all. You know? Right.
We're going to get back to our conversation with Rick, but right now I'd like to take a minute and tell you about Beth Koritz. She is a psychotherapist, intuitive clarity coach, and founder of the Authenticity Academy. For the past 12 years, she has been supporting her clients to fully embody their authenticity and create the life they desire with her three-step clarity coaching program. This is your time to gain clarity, defining yourself by who you really are and not what you do. Increase your confidence by activating your inner powers and take soul-led action, creating a life in alignment with your purpose, passions, and desires. Are you ready to learn more? Then book a free 30-minute clarity call with Beth Koritz. Visit www.yourclarity.coach or the sponsor page at themusicplaystheband.net. Beth is looking forward to supporting you on your journey. And now, back to our conversation with the late Rick Turner.
Some of those first Alembic guitars and basses, because you started with the bass, you said,
yeah,
those went straight into the hands of the guys in the Dead.
Yeah, the Alembic number one went to Jack Cassidy, And you saw that bass on White Rabbit at right. your gig in Felton.
Right.
And then, yeah, and the earliest instruments went into spectacular hands, you know.
Do you remember their reactions?
Huh?
Do you remember their reactions when they got these instruments?
Oh, yeah, they were delighted. I mean, you know, it was interesting because The Dead, The Airplane, to a lesser extent, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, primarily Crosby, were really funding research and development with all of this stuff. And the money was flowing like you wouldn't believe. And the suits hadn't taken over yet.
Right.
You know, so they were able, they trusted us. I know I gained a fair degree of trust because they knew that I was a musician. They knew where I was coming from, basically the same place. I diverged away from being primarily a musician to being primarily a luthier. But still, you know, I mean, Garcia was very aware of my work with Ian and Sylvia, for instance, and that kind of playing was close to his roots in, right. in music, you know, sort of bluegrass based flat picking is what I've been doing, you know. So we had a lot of trust from the musicians, and then we delivered the goods. You know, what had happened before Alembic became official was that I'd gotten into making pickups, took them out to Ron, who had figured out a way to measure the frequency response of the pickups. And it turned out that my pickups were better than anything he had ever tested. And then we figured out why. And it was because I was winding basically significantly lower impedance coils, larger wire, fewer turns.
I want to ask you about the difference. Well, first of all, I want to go back. When you started building the guitars, not just the pickups, what were some of the electric guitars that inspired you when you started building?
I had, in Auto Salvage, I'd played a 335, which was uncomfortable to me. I played a Strat. Then I got a, then I made Peanut, which I liked very much. And I also, oddly enough, had a Fender Duo Sonic that I really liked. And then I wound up with this amazing and now very rare Epiphone Coronet six-string bass that when I plugged it into a 410 Bassman and cranked it, sounded like a badass baritone saxophone, you know? So, and I was an early adopter of pedals. I mean, in 1967, I had a pedal board, you know, which is pretty rare in those days. So
are you taking like characteristics from each of these guitars that you like?
Well, yeah. And so, one of the reasons I got into basses first was because Jesse Colin Young ordered a bass, you know, so I built him a bass, you know. That led to the work with Phil and then Jack. And then, you know, of course, in those very early days of Alembic, we did a lot of modding. So you had... you know, the Strat that Graham Nash gave to Jerry,
right,
turning into what we now know as Alligator, you know. And a lot of that was, it's funny, you know, the musicians would come in and it would kind of be, got anything in mind? You know, it's like, and, you know, I'd also started making the metal parts in, pretty early on, before Alembic, I was making brass bridges and brass nuts and welded brass tail pieces and stuff like that. And somewhere along the line, came the idea of putting a big block of brass under the bridge as a sustain block. And then when I started building, the earliest instruments I built had a set neck, glued on neck. And then I realized, you know, for the limited tools that I have and for how much handwork I'm doing, it would be just as easy to run the neck all the way through the body. And so that became sort of the one of the defining aspects of the alembic instruments. And alembic number one, Jack's bass, has the neck through the body.
Right.
And it just became a relatively easy way to figure out how to build the instruments, you know. And a lot of this was also I was learning production woodworking as I went along. I mean, the funny thing is when we moved the factory up to Cotati from San Francisco, I met these guys in Sonoma who had they were responsible for the resurgence of oak toilet seats.
Oak toilet seats?
Toilet seats. And they had this factory in Sonoma making oak toilet seats and other bathroom accessories. I mean, the funny thing was they'd take a rectangular block of oak and they'd cut the perimeter of the toilet seat out. The corners would then be turned into towel bar brackets.
A whole bathroom set.
Yeah, exactly. The inside of the toilet seat would become a round towel holder. The inside of the round towel holder went off to a company that made wooden toys, and they'd become wheels. And wow. It was just, you know, so it was like incredibly efficient use of the wood. But also the place was really well set up with woodworking equipment, major stuff, shapers and overarm pin routers and all that kind of stuff. And I just absorbed how they were making stuff using templates and fixtures and all that, and adapted that to the making alembic guitars and basses.
How much does, I got two questions on this. How much does the wood make a
wood
difference
counts.
Sonically speaking, is the wood the most important thing in a guitar?
No, the hands of the player are the most important thing.
But of course. But getting wood, the human out of the area.
Yeah, wood counts and necks are really important. One end of the string is attached to the body, the other is attached to the neck, you know. And the string is vibrating and putting energy in, and the energy is bouncing back at both ends. And one of the things that we realized with alembic was that a stiff neck was a good thing because it would reflect string energy. It wouldn't suck the energy out of the string. It would reflect it back into the string, and that meant sustain.
That kind of leads me into a question I was going to ask you later, but I'm going to go there now because you're talking about that stiff neck. Is that where later on when you guys came up with the concept of a graphite guitar neck, is that the
Absolutely.
Reason?
Absolutely. 100%. 100%. That's exactly where we went to. That one was interesting because in about 1976, I think it was 76, early 76. I read this article in, I think it was Mechanics Illustrated, on the Mossman carbon fiber graphite bicycle frame. This was the first bicycle made out of carbon fiber. And Mossman, the funny thing was, they were a shotgun company, Mossberg. Anyway, somehow or other, they'd gone off into this, you know, let's let's make a carbon fiber bicycle. And it was tubular construction. And my brain went, bingo. And right about that time, Jeff Gould came by Alembic's store in San Francisco and left off some samples of carbon fiber and aluminum honeycomb and satellite antenna. He was working for a company called Aeroneutronic, which is a division of Ford Aerospace. And he was a deadhead. And he, I believe, was thinking in terms of, gee, they could make speaker cones out of this stuff that would be incredibly stiff and lightweight and wouldn't break up. I saw this stuff and I went the other way and said, no, we, you know, yeah, that could work, but base necks. And so, you know, I understood enough about molding fiberglass and materials like that, which is kind of similar to molding carbon fiber, to make a master of a base neck that had the right relief angles in it to be able to get parts out of the mold. And took it down to Aeroneutronic, and they made a mold, and bingo, they came up with a couple of necks, put it all together with 5-minute epoxy, and got it together, and it worked. It was great. It was stiffer than hell, and it sounded great, and it was right about the time that Fleetwood Mac was recording Rumors in Sausalito. So I took it down and showed it to John McVie. This is a whole other story, and he said, oh, I want it. Bingo. So John McVie got the first carbon fiber base neck. We did show it at NAMM, and we immediately applied for a patent on it, which came through in 78, I think it was. And so that was the startup of that became the startup of Modulus.
Right. Let me ask you this. All this work, whether it's with the wood or the carbon fiber or any of it, all this meticulous work that you do on these guitars is completely by hand. What's your favorite part of the build?
It's
by the way, Brad Sarno wanted me to ask you that question.
It's chasing the invention. You know, it turns out that I don't have schooling in engineering, but I have a very good intuitive understanding of how this shit works, you know. Right. And it has served me well for decades now, you know. I also have this attitude about making stuff, which is that it's stuff. It's not, I'm a metal worker, I'm a woodworker, I'm a this, I'm a that. No, you're making stuff. And you figure it out, you know. It's funny, two of my sons are very adept with their hands, too. My oldest son has an amazing high-end architectural metalworking shop in Marin. And he's got the same attitude. I mean, wood, metal, it's all the same. You know, okay, so you use screws over here, use bolts over here, whatever, you know. And anything that you need to make that you haven't made before, there's a process, a sequence of operations for any of this stuff. And you do it. And when you come up against something you don't know how to do, you ask somebody, you figure it out, whatever, you know. And so it's really a mindset, knowing how to make stuff. And it almost doesn't matter what it's made out of. You can figure out how to work with it, you know, whether it's casting plastics or making silicon rubber molds to make pickups or whatever. It's just stuff. And each bit of stuff has its specific techniques and materials. But once you get into it, it's all the same, you know? Right.
It's just stuff.
It's just stuff.
Wow, that's amazing stuff. Quite the history lesson right there. When we return, we're going to hear Rick talk about the genesis and construction of the Grateful Dead's famous wall of sound. This portion of the podcast is brought to you by Grateful Sweats. Grateful Sweats' subtle song designs will strike a chord for heads who get it. Search Grateful Sweats on Etsy for a wide selection of gear like hoodies, beanies, and of course sweatpants, as well as other Grateful goodies with more than 30 designs, like Tennessee Jed, Women Are Smarter, and my personal favorite, Eyes of the World. Visit Etsy.com/shop/GratefulSweats or get there from the sponsor page at our website. And right now, if you use the code THEMUSICPLAYS, you can save 10% and receive a free pin. And don't miss the clearance section with items up to 80% off. So as soon as you're done listening today, head on over to Grateful Sweats.
I want to move on from the guitars, if you don't mind. And,
yeah.
And I'd like, let's talk a bit about your work in sound reinforcement with the Dead, specifically the wall of sound.
Now, it's just stuff.
It's just stuff. There you go. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That was Rick Turner. I've had Brad come on the show. You know, Brad's on my, appears regularly and he sponsors this segment. And he's explained to the folks that are listening about the concept, you know, of each player having their own channel and their own tower of speakers. And their individual control. But I got to ask you, since they already kind of know what it is, how in the world did you guys come up with this?
Well, physics. It's all based on physics. You know, Ron and I took a sound system design course by this guy, Don Davis, Sin Odcon. And the Sin Odcon course reinforced a bunch of stuff that we already were, that we knew and were thinking, and it introduced us to some new ways of thinking about it and measuring the results. One of the keys was that for sound system design, particularly for indoors, there is this critical distance in a hall away from the stage, and at that critical distance the reverberation of the room takes over from the direct sound of the sound system and you get mud. And so what you want to do is you want to push that critical distance as far to the back wall as you possibly can. You know, the ideal for sound systems is outdoors, because you're only dealing with one reflective surface, and that's the ground, and the people on it, and that tends to dampen things a lot. You go indoors, and you've got reflections from the back wall. You got that slap back. You got off of the side walls. You got off of the ceiling, and you got off the back wall, and it all leads to a big, confusing bunch of mush. And ideally, a sound system would hit the audience only and never bounce off of any surfaces. So when you're designing a sound system, you want to design for maximum directivity, directing it to the audience. The other thing that you want to do is you want to get distance. You want to project. And ideally, you project without it being too loud up front and too weak way in back. Well, an RCA engineer named Harry Olson, who is responsible for much of the modern design of the ribbon microphone, among the guy's got dozens of patents. He was a genius. He did a whole bunch of studies. You know, one was just like, what does the shape of a speaker cabinet have to do with the dispersion of sound? And so he did all these experiments. And then he got into the whole thing of line array theory. And so the line array theory became the central focus of our work with the wall of sound.
So that's really the precursor to the line array. This is the original line array.
Well, the individual per person is kind of a separate issue from the line array theory itself. Okay. So the wall of sound wound up being, what is it, 6 or 7 line arrays.
Gotcha. Okay.
That gets back to not wanting to mix the sound together and have them intermodulate and distort one another out of normal speaker cabinets, you know, a normal thing. The other thing is that Baer was adamantly opposed to what we think of as normal stereo. And when you think about it, stereo as we know it doesn't work. And particularly in live sound, you know, if you're 30 feet closer to the left stack than you are to the right stack, you got a delay happening in what you're hearing.
Well, one of the things I wondered about that, and I asked Brad, and he wasn't sure if let's say, so in each of those stacks was only that one instrument, and that was the only tower it was coming out of, correct?
Yes, correct.
So if someone's on the right side of the room, are they still hearing clearly what's coming out of a tower that's way on the other side of the
stage?
They're
not hearing it. They're not hearing it as well, but because the line array basically controls the vertical dispersion of sound and widens the horizontal dispersion. You know, think of it as like a pipe organ, where, you know, each note is coming from a discrete.
Right. Note. Sure. Of course. Across the. Of course. Yeah. Okay.
So no, you're not going to hear the same mix if you're far stage right or far stage left, but you can also, the brain is a strange thing when it comes to interpreting sounds. There is, for instance, what is known as the cocktail party effect, where you can be in a room full of people, and if you want to pay attention to two people who are over there talking to one another, you can tune out the other people in the room to a certain degree. And it has to do with the phase relationship of sound in our ears more than the physical volume. There's another thing that Baer was adamant about, was that phase relationships are what it's about, far more important than relative loudness levels. And and so the thing is, with the wall of sound, you could be in the audience and feel that the guitar sound was coming from there, not there and there and there and there and there, you know. And with the cluster vocal, the vocal cluster over in the center, there was much more of a feeling that the vocals were coming from the singers, not, you know, something over there and something 50 feet over there, you know.
Right.
So the integration of sound and visual, of seeing the band and hearing the band, it was a much tighter integration than we are currently used to with the way sound systems work.
This thing was huge. It's a Herculean task what you're doing there. And
oh, it's ridiculous.
It had to cost a small fortune. So did you guys just go to the band?
A large fortune.
Okay, so it had to cost a large fortune. So do you just go to the band and say, hey, this is what we want to do. Can we have some money?
No, it was funny because at about the time that that Alembic moved to the 60 Brady Street studio, which was quite an endeavor, The band decided that renting the sound system from us was costing too much money, and it would cost them a lot less if they owned it. Well, they started playing larger and larger venues, and because we were the sound system guys, it was like, okay, what are we going to do? And, you know, and Bear, in 1969, I heard Bear tell the band, the solution is to put the PA behind the band. Everybody thought he was out of his mind. It couldn't possibly work. So the system starts getting bigger and bigger. We wind up, 73, I don't know, Boston Music Hall. I was on the road with him. There were still the Ampex MX-10 mixers being used. I was doing a lot of the front of house mixing. We get to the Boston Music Hall, and between the backline and the PA, there's no room for the PA. The stage wasn't wide enough. So it was, okay, bring in the scaffolding and put the PA up top. That was the first gig where the PA went behind the band.
Wow. And so it was happy accident almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
The other funny thing about that gig was that I was the guy from Boston. I knew my way around. Well, the city of Boston had changed every street in Boston to being one way against me, you know. Anyway, and that was the memorable gig where, oh, this works. And anyway, so we sold the system to the band. And it had to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it was like, okay, it works behind the band. Now let's go for it. We'd already started, you know, making columns of speakers taller and taller. And now it was like, okay, what are the wavelengths involved? Well, we got to go 40 feet tall for the low end. And so, because that... that would control the vertical dispersion and project the low end out. See, with a line array, in theory, the sound is coming in a cylindrical wavefront. The surface of a cylinder increases at the square of the distance, and the drop off of sound is the inverse of that. With a point source, you're dealing with the cube of the distance. So point sources drop off an order of magnitude faster than they do with a cylindrical line array. And that's why you can be up close to the line array and then walk back, and it just doesn't drop off all that rapidly, you know? One gig, Santa Barbara gig, Ron and I, this is when the full wall of sound was happening. We must have walked back between a quarter and a half a mile away from the stage. And it was clear as a bell.
So amazing.
You know? And then, you know, of course, the other big thing was that, you know, that vocals weren't mixed with instruments in the speakers. So you had this clarity that has not been duplicated to this day.
Right.
You know, there were issues. Of course, there were issues. The noise-canceling mics. If you got off mic a bit, you lost it, you know. So mic techniques had to change, and right. That was a real problem at times, you know. And if the singer was moving in and out at all, that would get pretty weird. But used properly, they worked great. Happen to think that technology bears a second look. The overlooked thing about the noise-canceling mics is that they totally canceled out backline sound coming in. So you didn't have that delay of whatever, 20 feet or so of backline coming in, mixing with the normal mic'd part of the backline. Once again, you get this phase cancellation and confusion. So by not having backline in the bleeding through into the PA, that was also cleaning things up.
Right.
I think some of these ideas bear a second look.
Right.
Given, you know, we know what the problems were, but we also know what the advantages were, and that backline cancellation is a pretty big deal. They subsequently, when they got away from the noise canceling mics, they went to the mats on the floor that would turn the mics
right.
on.
Right, we use that.
Yeah,
we use
and
that
that's technology. And for the same reason, because you right. don't get backline into the PA. Yeah,
so you have that to deal with, and something like this has never been attempted. So I'm sure there's all kinds of problems along the way. Tell me if you can think of the one, the trials and tribulations, that horror story that goes along with this wall of sound.
Well, there was that Stanford gig where all the tweeters blew out, you know, but, you know, hey, what the hell, you know. There is that ties into a funny one. One of the guys who worked for Alembic and then wound up working for the Dead, Dennis Wiz Leonard, Alembic was a JBL EV and Macintosh dealer. And so, you know, we sold the band all the gear. So Wiz becomes the Recone expert and pretty busy at that. So somebody at JBL figures out that Wiz has been mixing and matching speaker cone parts. He's been putting paper domes onto D120s to turn them into, you know, the D120 that had the aluminum dome. And somebody at JBL freaked out that we were modding JBL speakers. And they called Wiz up and said, you know, you can't do this anymore. We're not going to allow you to buy parts from us to do this. And Wiz went to Ron and said, God, what do I do? What do I do? And Ron said, call him back and say, fine, Electro Voice would like our business. Well, that was the end of that.
Right.
All the parts you want, baby.
as amazing as this thing was, as groundbreaking as it was, as wonderful as it sounded, as cool looking as it was, it was a behemoth that was nearly impossible to tour with the thing. Am I right?
Yeah, they wound up with two sets of scaffolding. There's a myth out there that there were two walls of sound. There weren't.
Just the structure.
Scaffolding that would leapfrog. And yeah, it was a ball buster, you know. I think the concepts could be applied to gear today. And for one thing, you just automatically give up on the idea that human beings are going to pick up speaker cabinets and move them. You go, okay, this is all forklift land, you know. Right. Then the other would be to basically make the speakers become their own scaffolding in locking together and all that, you know.
Right, right.
So there are also, you know, now, geez, what are we, nearly 50 years later?
God,
yeah. There are smaller, lighter drivers that do just as well, much smaller and lighter power amps that do just as well. You would, in a modern wall of sound, you would want to have them be powered speaker cabinets. You'd build the power amps in.
Right.
The other thing you could do, which Rinkus Hines has done, is you can do a digital front end in the speaker cabinets, and then literally with phasing the speakers, you can essentially, you can have a vertical line array, but you can tilt the sound as you wish by doing phase delays in the sound. And that's a really, that's a major breakthrough. But also, you know, the, you know, Class D digital power amps these days, there's so much power and so little weight. And it's gotten to the point where some of them are awfully hi-fi, and particularly for driving the low end, you can do it. It's still very hard to get away from wavelengths, you know, so you'd still want to do a 40-foot tall column for the low end.
Do you think any of this stuff, any of this new stuff that you're talking about, in all honesty, sounds as good or sounds better than the wall of sound, or was that the pinnacle right there?
I think a modern system with modern drivers could sound at least as good as the wall of sound.
Wow.
Particularly when you get into the all-important mid-range, there are amazing cone mid-range drivers these days, and dome mid-range drivers. You know, there's some great stuff. You might be able to even pull it down from being a four-way system into a three-way system, and that simplifies things a bit.
Right.
You know, because these full range drivers and wide range mid range drivers these days are just amazing. You know, so
none of it will ever look as cool, that's for sure. No, we know that.
No.
no one's going to be like making their Lego models and their home replicas of this like they are. No.
That Anthony Koski mini wall of sound is just brilliant. It's so cool.
We've been following it on Facebook. Well, man.
Oh yeah. I've been in touch with him.
Oh, you have? That's great.
Giving him full encouragement on it. And yeah,
that's so awesome. Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for sharing all this with me and with the listeners. I mean, this is not only the guitars and the wall of sound and all that are a huge part of the Grateful Dead's history. And it's wonderful to have you on and help me share that with everybody and, you know, give them a chance to learn a little bit more about it right from, for lack of a better term, right from the horse's mouth.
Great. Great, Rob.
So
greatly appreciate it. And I really look forward to seeing you guys again soon. You know,
we will be out again. I enjoyed hanging last time and I'm looking forward to spending some more time with you. So everybody, a big thank you. That's Rick Turner hanging out with us today. Thank you, my friend.
Great. Okay. Best of the band.
I appreciate that. Wow. I feel so fortunate to have Rick's story documented in spoken form, and I'll always be thankful for the time I got to spend with him. So thank you and rest in peace, Rick Turner. And that's going to bring us to the end of the episode, and I'd like to thank my sponsors, Grateful Sweats and Beth Koritz at yourclarity.coach. And of course, the Pantheon Podcast Network for bringing me into their family. You can check out their 70-plus music-related podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. If you enjoyed the show and would like to support the cause, please consider a monthly Patreon subscription that offers some great bonus content every week. Or you can show your love with a one-time contribution, and please remember that a portion of your contribution will go to the Rex Foundation. Get info about this and everything related to the podcast at our website, www.themusicplaystheband.net. Any love is much appreciated as we try and keep the show rolling along. The Music Plays the Band is produced by myself and the production and songwriting team Brothers Lazaroff here in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find out more about them at www.brotherslazaroff.com. The opening and segue music you are hearing are remixes of portions of DSO drum segments that are produced by my drumming partner Dino English. I'm about to hit the road, but I will be back as soon as I can with episode number 35. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and please stay vigilant. Things are good right now, and it's getting better, and we really want to keep it headed in that direction. Thanks for being here, and we'll see you out on the road.